of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center. I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Wednesday, January 6th, 2021. From the Recording Library of West Texas, I'm Michael. Coming up in the next few minutes, we'll be reading articles that include U.S. states call in National Guard as country hits daily COVID-19 death toll record. U.S. vaccine administration slows to 28% of distributed doses, CDC vaccine tracker shows. Private payrolls unexpectedly shrank in December, a red flag for the slowing economy. The coronavirus intensified a hunger crisis last year, but 2021 could be worse. And we have a few Texas-based articles, including COVID-19 exhausting Texas ICU beds as hospitalizations soar, and Texas on brink of record 13,000 in hospitals as virus surges. First, we'll check the numbers. From the Odessa American, editor's note, Ector County last updated COVID-19 numbers Tuesday, December 29th. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 11,543. Ector County negative, 37,671 out of 49,695 tested, with 481 pending, 181 deaths. Recovered, 9,711. Active, 1,651. ECISD daily cases, 4 students, 3 staff. And the Midland Reporter-Telegram, in an article, reports these numbers. New Midland health numbers reported Tuesday showed a new record for people who tested positive for COVID-19 last week at Midland Health testing centers. Midland Health, on its website, reported Tuesday that 407 people tested positive for coronavirus. That was more than the 401 people who tested positive the week of November 21st. Midland Health also reported the number of tests recorded was 1,372, so the positivity rate moved to 29.7%. That trailed the July 4th week, 31.8%, as far as the highest positivity rate in 1 week. Midland Health also reported that 114 people have tested positive this week. The positivity rate this week, as of Tuesday morning, is 28.1%. Just as the number of people testing positive and the positivity percentages continue to spike, the city of Midland on Tuesday reported another 3 COVID-19-related deaths, which took place in December. 2 happened December 29th. The other death took place on December 23rd. All 3 were being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital and had underlying conditions. The 3 reported Tuesday brought the number of Midland County resident deaths during the pandemic to 190. The number of coronavirus cases continued its upward trend. On Tuesday, Midland Health Department officials reported 187 cases for Monday. That increased the number of cases to 287 this week, and the number of cases during the pandemic, confirmed and unconfirmed, to 13,813. Other notable numbers include the percentage of COVID patients of total rooms at Midland Memorial Hospital fell from 32% to 29%. 29% is the 7-day average. The percentage of COVID rooms filled is 90%. 86% is the 7-day average. Of the 295 inpatient rooms, 247 rooms, or 84%, are filled. The 7-day average is 81%. And then I'm going to read part of an article that is from the front page of today's Midland Reporter Telegram, and that is 2,200 Midlanders sign up for COVID-19 vaccine wait list. More than 2,200 people reserved a slot on the Midland Health Department's COVID-19 vaccine wait list after it was open for individuals age 65 and older or with a chronic health condition, according to a city spokeswoman. the health department received the shipment of the Moderna vaccine on December 29th. By the next day, appointments for all 200 doses had already been booked. A city spokeswoman said 2,211 people had added their names to the health department's wait list as of Tuesday morning. Health department officials don't yet know when they'll receive another shipment, she said. Whitney Craig with the health department previously said in an interview that they expect the next shipment will also include 200 doses. Vaccine rollouts have moved slowly and have been met with confusion throughout the state and nation. Governor Greg Abbott said on December 22nd that 1.4 million healthcare workers and at-risk Texans would be vaccinated by the end of 2020, but that didn't happen. Texas's Health and Human Services COVID-19 dashboard on Tuesday showed that just 439,000 Texans have received the vaccine, meaning more than half of the 1.3 million doses shipped to the state have yet to be administered. Midland Memorial Hospital received 1,950 doses of the Pfizer vaccine December 17th and immediately began administering it to staff. Any remaining doses, because of workers who declined the vaccine, were given to other healthcare providers in the community, according to hospital officials. Just more than 1,000 Midland County residents, or 0.8% of the population, had received an initial dose of the vaccine as of Tuesday, according to the state's dashboard. No one in the county or state has yet received the second dose of the vaccine required for full immunization. It would be at least 11 months before just those on the waiting list receive initial doses if the number of doses and frequency of shipments stays the same. In December, the Department of Health and Human Services reported that the Trump administration, through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Department of Defense, will purchase an additional 100 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine from Pfizer. Texas DSHS stated in a memo that they're expecting a vaccine to be available to the general population by spring of this year, but that could change depending on vaccine production and how quickly other vaccines become available. The form to join the Midland Health Department's wait list is available at midlandtexas.gov/forms.aspx?FID=159. And now from the Texas Tribune. One in five hospital beds in Texas are now occupied by COVID patients. Average new cases in Texas increased by 3,190 confirmed cases compared with the seven-day average a week ago. On January 5th, 26,543 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 1,533 patients compared with a week ago. As of January 5th, 13,308 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased in Texas by 43 deaths compared with the seven-day average a week ago. On January 5th, 250 new deaths were reported. And now here are coronavirus briefs. Wealthy donors to one Florida nursing home received coronavirus vaccines that were supposed to be reserved for staff members and residents, prompting frustration and outrage as less affluent senior citizens camp out in long lines to be immunized. The United States continues to shatter records for coronavirus-related hospitalizations, with more than 131,000 people nationwide receiving inpatient treatment on Tuesday following the holidays, and the case surge has also limited the vaccine rollout, officials say. In less than a week, more than 1,000 people have died of coronavirus in Los Angeles County. California orders hospitals to delay non-essential surgeries in regions hardest hit by COVID-19 surge. Operation Warp Speed says it distributed 3 million coronavirus vaccines Tuesday. Texas Congressman Kevin Brady says he's tested positive for COVID-19. Brady, a ranking member of the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee, said he will begin treatment Wednesday. An already scaled-back Grammy Awards ceremony has been postponed due to the deteriorating COVID situation in Los Angeles, where intensive care units are at capacity and ambulances are told to ration oxygen. Some Native American tribes are prioritizing vaccinations for speakers of endangered languages. The World Bank has downgraded its global economic forecast for the coming decade, saying Tuesday that a decade of growth disappointments could be on the way if policymakers don't take swift action. The head of the World Health Organization is very disappointed that scientists investigating the origins of COVID-19 were prevented from entering China due to delayed paperwork. And now here are some short articles. The U.S. recorded at least 3,775 COVID-19 deaths on Tuesday. That's a new record from CNN's Joe Sutton in Atlanta. At least 3,775 COVID-19 deaths were reported in the United States on Tuesday, according to data from Johns Hopkins University, the highest number of fatalities recorded in a single day since the pandemic began. Nationwide, there were at least 229,055 new cases of COVID-19 reported Tuesday. To date, there have been 21,046,195 cases of coronavirus in the U.S. At least 357,258 people have died. The totals include cases from all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and other U.S. territories, as well as repatriated cases. U.S. states call in National Guard as country hits daily COVID-19 death toll record, from CNN's Christina Maxouris. The U.S. reported its highest daily COVID-19 death count ever Tuesday, a grim milestone that comes as state leaders work urgently to combat a slow pace of vaccinations. More than 3,770 American deaths were reported in one day, more than two dozen above the country's previous record, set less than a week ago. The country also topped 21 million infections Tuesday and set a hospitalization record with more than 131,100 COVID-19 hospitalized patients nationwide, according to the COVID Tracking Project. As numbers climb, U.S. governors are now taking new measures to get the distributed vaccines into arms faster, including mobilizing National Guard members and training more volunteers to administer vaccines. U.S. vaccine administration slows to 28% of distributed doses, CDC vaccine tracker shows, from CNN's Deidre McPhillips. The pace of COVID-19 vaccine administration in the United States continues to slow, according to data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. As of 9 a.m. Tuesday, just 4.8 million of the 17 million doses distributed had been administered, or 28%. That figure was closer to 30% on Monday and 33% over the weekend. Private payrolls unexpectedly shrank in December, a red flag for a slowing economy, by Taylor Telford. Private payrolls unexpectedly contracted in December for the first time in 7 months, the ADP Research Institute reported Wednesday, a signal that the economic recovery is stalling amid a nationwide coronavirus surge. Analysts had predicted that holiday shopping would boost private payrolls by 60,000 positions in the final month of 2020. Instead, payrolls decreased by 123,000 positions as businesses grappled with renewed restrictions and declining traffic. On the eve of the new year, nearly 20 million Americans remained on unemployment, a jobs crisis worse than during the Great Recession. The job losses were concentrated in the retail, leisure, and hospitality sectors, ADP Vice President Ahu Yildirimaz said in a news release. Small businesses and the services sector were hit especially hard, but financial pressure also led such giants as Coca-Cola and 3M to announce layoffs. Some job growth was seen in manufacturing and the professional and business services, but the overall picture looked bleak. The heart of every recession is job losses, and right now the decline in jobs at year-end is hinting that the dark days of the labor market last spring have returned. Chris Rupke, chief financial economist at MUFG Union Bank, said Tuesday in an email to the Washington Post. Experts are looking toward December's monthly jobs report due Friday from the Bureau of Labor Statistics for a more detailed picture of the economy. The coronavirus intensified a hunger crisis last year, but 2021 could be worse, by Sibahan O'Grady from the Washington Post. The coronavirus pandemic unleashed cascades of suffering in 2020. People around the globe faced the threat of the virus, along with the devastating ripple effects of efforts to control its spread. For much of the world, the legacy of the pandemic will be impossible to untangle from the stark material inequities that worsened it and that it exacerbated. Among the most dangerous of these, a mounting hunger crisis set to grow even more dire in 2021. The World Food Program, the branch of the United Nations responsible for delivering life-saving food assistance, expects to need to serve 138 million people this year, more ever than its 60-year-old history. The rise in hunger is due to what I call the three C's, conflict, COVID, and climate, said Steve Taravella, a WFP spokesman. We don't take the word famine loosely, but with famine looming in several countries at once, we're facing a genuine crisis. Now, here are some Texas articles from the Associated Press. COVID-19 exhausting Texas ICU beds as hospitalizations soar. Published January 5th. Coronavirus cases are exhausting the availability of intensive care unit beds in parts of Texas as hospitalizations with COVID-19 continue to soar to record levels, state health statistics showed on Tuesday. Hospitalizations with the illness the coronavirus causes set a ninth consecutive record by topping 13,300 on Tuesday, with 626 patients requiring intensive care, according to the Texas Department of State Health Services. In all, the state estimated 314,465 COVID-19 cases were active. All ICU beds at hospitals in the Abilene and Bryan College Station areas are full, while only two are available in the Laredo area, with three in the Paris Texarkana area. ICU bed availability is in the single digits in the Wichita Falls, Northwest Texas, Lufkin Piney Woods, Waco, Galveston Beaumont, and Victoria areas. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo tweeted that the Houston region officially topped the state's hospitalization threshold, triggering COVID-19 reopening rollbacks. For 7 days in a row, COVID-19 patients have filled in 15% of Houston's region's hospital beds, according to state health statistics. Under those conditions, Republican Governor Greg Abbott has allowed county officials to ratchet back the number of people allowed in restaurants and other businesses from 75% of their capacity to 50%, and require hospitals to postpone elective surgeries. Bars also must close, although Harris County bars never reopened bars after Abbott allowed counties to keep them closed. Honestly, this is just another milestone on a road to a catastrophe unless each of us acts. We can't rely on a small occupancy rollback. Do your part, she tweeted. But U.S. Representative Dan Crenshaw, the Republican congressman representing some of Houston's northern suburbs, urged the public to ignore the appeal by Hidalgo, a Democrat. Businesses should not comply. Lockdowns are not supported by law. They are unconstitutional edicts. Law enforcement should not enforce this. Stop stealing people's right to make a living, Crenshaw tweeted. The state reported 26,543 new confirmed coronavirus cases and 3,637 new probable cases Tuesday, bringing the total in Texas for the eight-month outbreak to more than 1.6 million. The 250 newly reported deaths brought the state's total death toll to 28,219. Now here's a longer article from the Washington Post. The Technology 202, website crashes and other tech problems plague early coronavirus vaccine rollout, by Kat Zakarsky, published January 5th. Technical problems are already hampering the early rollout of the coronavirus vaccine. Websites in multiple large Florida counties buckled from a surge of traffic in recent days as seniors attempted to book appointments for their vaccinations. Many were instead met with error messages. Outages were reported in Broward, Pinellas, and Hillsborough counties. Other seniors thought they secured appointments online, only to be disappointed when they showed up to receive the vaccine. David Kornblah, an 85-year-old retired IT professional, told the South Florida Sun Sentinel that he and his wife booked a 10 a.m. appointment Monday morning in Coconut Creek. But when they got there, they were told they couldn't get a shot because they didn't have an electronic confirmation. "I don't want to die because I couldn't get vaccinated because of an IT glitch," he told the Florida paper. They just put up a website that was incapable of supporting the kind of volume that they were going to have. "It's incompetent state management," Kornblah said, as he and his wife were unable to rebook their appointments since the Broward County website then went down. Local health departments across the country are scrambling to deploy vaccination appointment booking systems. Tech experts say the problems are in part due to the lack of national coordination on building websites to distribute vaccines. Instead, local public health officials with limited budgets and access to technical resources are taking on the challenges of rolling out websites that are able to handle the massive demand for vaccine bookings. State and local health agencies are doing a Herculean task right now, where they're coordinating the fastest vaccine rollout in modern history in the U.S., and they're doing it without leadership from the federal government, said Raphael Lee, who directs the health program at U.S. Digital Response, which coordinates tech volunteers to help governments respond to crises. "The result has been a patchwork of different types of websites and web forms, and many technical problems throughout the country." Harris County in Texas had to take down its website after people across the county who were not yet eligible began to sign up for inoculations. Currently, only healthcare workers and people over the age of 65 with severe health problems are eligible in the county. Hospital systems have also reported similar issues. Mass General Brigham, the largest healthcare system in Massachusetts, had to shut down its employee vaccine booking website after it crashed due to a surge in demand from employees. More broadly, relying on websites to book coronavirus vaccines risks leaving behind some populations that need the vaccine the most. Only 73% of Americans over the age of 65 use the internet, according to data from the Pew Research Center. Lee said it's important for counties to ensure their websites are properly working so phone lines aren't tied up. Some health departments are turning to consumer tech services to book appointments, raising other concerns. Rather than building their own websites, some counties are turning to services such as Eventbrite or social media to help people schedule their vaccines. But it's not clear that Eventbrite, which is known for helping people book tickets to concerts or conferences, is equipped to handle sensitive health data. The company did not respond to a request for comment. Government websites have been famously plagued by technical issues for years. Experts say counties can learn from those mistakes. Early in the pandemic, websites for unemployment benefits crashed throughout the country as record numbers of Americans sought support as they lost their jobs. Lee tells me that health agencies should be praised for being creative in thinking about how to use the off-the-shelf solutions that people are already familiar with to roll out the vaccine. But he warned that they should be looking closely at ensuring that the systems can keep people's data secure and communicate with other vaccine management platforms. USDR has developed a set of criteria for local health departments to consider when choosing tech vendors, and it's also working as connective tissue to keep counties updated on what's working well in other states and cities across the United States, Lee says. Every county and state has a slightly different plan, so it's hard to say there's one-size-fits-all solutions that people can just grab off the shelf, Lee said. But we can say, if you haven't thought about this, you probably should. A high-profile healthcare venture backed by Amazon will shut down next month. Haven, which was created 2 years ago by the e-commerce giant J.P. Morgan Chase and Berkshire Hathaway, announced the shutdown in a brief online statement, J. Green reports. Haven aimed to address rising healthcare costs and improve patient outcomes, and its closure is a sharp departure from the early ambition and excitement surrounding the initiative. Moving forward, Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and J.P. Morgan Chase & Company will leverage these insights and continue to collaborate informally to design programs tailored to address the specific needs of their own employee populations, Haven wrote. Haven will end its independent operations at the end of February 2021. The company had 57 employees. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. Despite the shutdown, expect Amazon to continue to have a strong presence in healthcare. The company in November unveiled the Amazon Pharmacy, and it has acquired companies in the healthcare space such as PillPack. And now I'm going to read one final article. This one is also from the Washington Post and comes from their perspective section. To survive the pandemic, exercise and eat healthy, just like a basketball star. Column by Cortland Malloy, published January 5th. When Brooklyn Nets basketball star Kevin Durant tested positive for the coronavirus last year, he underwent a few weeks of quarantine, then was back to normal. And when he came in contact with an infected person last week, Durant began another 7-day quarantine. Durant, the coaches tell us, is expected to miss 4 games in 7 days, then return to the court. No ifs or buts about it. He is fully expected to be back in the game, good as new. What they don't tell us, though, is what, if any, treatments or special care Durant might be receiving that make it possible for him and several other professional athletes to seemingly shake off a potentially deadly virus as if it was little more than a common cold. In the last week of December, 21 National Football League players tested positive for the virus, but not one ended up in a hospital or on a ventilator. In a few days, some will be back on the field, banging into each other with reckless abandon. I'm alive. Durant, who was asymptomatic when he tested positive last March, told the Post in a May interview. That's it. That's all I can tell you. I'm good. The unknown is always scary, but I had a lot of support. I knew if I needed anything, I could call someone. Good for Durant, but what about the rest of us? The vaccine rollout appears to have bogged down, but not the virus. The coronavirus is spreading faster than ever, with hospitalizations and deaths from infection increasing daily. I called Reed V. Tuckson, former D.C. Health Commissioner and chairman of the Black Coalition Against COVID-19. The group is hosting a virtual town hall meeting at 7 p.m. Thursday that will address many questions about the vaccine and what must be done to survive a pandemic that is killing black people at 3 times the rate of whites. Tuckson told me that not having underlying medical conditions like diabetes, heart disease, asthma, and obesity does improve one's chances of surviving COVID-19. Of course, underlying medical conditions impact a significant number of African Americans. But that doesn't mean we can't improve our chances of survival by eating healthier, getting exercise, and adequate rest. Anything to keep from having to go to a hospital these days. So, best to avoid needing to go to a hospital if at all possible. Wear masks, maintain social distancing, wash your hands. That simple bit of advice is as crucial now as it was at the beginning of the pandemic. One important thing that often gets overlooked is rest, Tuckson said. Give your body a chance to heal, and that means sleep. Don't get stressed out, emotionally or physically. Eat a healthy diet. As much as we might want to treat ourselves with comfort foods, now is not the time to overdo it with cupcakes and cookies. Give the body the nutrients that it needs, and make sure you drink enough water, stay hydrated. If things like multivitamins and zinc make you feel psychologically better, okay, Tuckson said. But everything in moderation, and know that there are no magic cures. A vaccine is on the way, so do what you can to stay healthy until you can get that shot. He said if someone is worried that they might have been exposed to coronavirus, the first thing they should do is take their temperature. I'd check for a fever. I'd check for loss of taste and or smell and shortness of breath, Tuckson said. Then I'd get tested and go isolate until I got the results. He'd also make note of when the symptoms first appeared and try to recall who he came in contact with. And if the test results come back positive, he'd try to reach the people who may have been infected. I'd feel morally responsible to alert those people whose homes I had visited or who had visited my home, he said. I'd want them to get tested. I'd be careful not to give the appearance of blaming anybody. You want to watch the symptoms, and if you find that you are having trouble breathing or you have a fever that doesn't break, then you need to go to the hospital emergency room for further evaluation. But maybe we can do like the pros and avoid hospitalization. Maybe we can get ourselves in better physical condition. Maybe we can stay healthy enough so that even if we get the disease, the odds of survival will be heavily in our favor. And that wraps up our coronavirus update for today, January 6, 2021, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and coming up next to fill for time until we get to 2 o'clock will be the show Eyes on Success. Following that, national news from USA Today. And then at 3 o'clock, our local newspapers. And here are some of the articles that our volunteers will be reading this afternoon. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram's front page, energy, $50 oil positive indicator, but uncertainty remains. Analysts say the higher price is a positive indicator, but don't expect any immediate reaction. Coronavirus, 2,200 Midlanders sign up for COVID vaccine waitlist. Weather. National Weather Service says 2020 in Midland is historical for its heat and lack of rain. And from the Odessa American front page this Wednesday, MCH hopes to make large impact in second round. Health officials warn of scams. First 2021 council session full of fireworks. Tempers and words flare during heated and long work meeting. And new teacher prep program coming to UTPB. Those articles and more are on their way at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and then we'll bring you more news from the Wall Street Journal this evening at 6. And following that, we'll bring you an encore presentation at 7 o'clock of our locally produced podcast, the Center Solutions Podcast, hosted by our executive director, Bailey Hennis, and also includes co-hosts Melanie Zeiss and Christy Edwards from Centers for Family and Children. Thank you, as always, for joining us today. We will, of course, be back tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock at this time. In the meanwhile, stay well and be safe and have a great day.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 52 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program covering a wide variety of topics of interest to people with vision loss. I'm Nancy Goodman-Torpey.
And I'm Pete Torpey.
What we should take away from iOS 14 and these machine learning-based, AI-based features is how much can be done and how Apple will build on it, and also what kind of different products they might create based on this technology.
That was Shelley Brisbane, who authored yet another book on iOS devices. Each year she updates the book, and this year we'll be talking about what is a great reference and also a great book about what's new in each version.
But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Shelley Brisbane.
Well, here's my tip. We talked a lot about the recognition features, voiceover recognition features, and the one that is the most fun and also the most useful is image recognition. And I, as somebody with a visual impairment, had a habit of dropping things and then they roll away and then I can't find them. I'm really liking using the magnifier app with image recognition turned on to just sort of scan my floor. You have to move your phone really slowly because sometimes the voiceover gets ahead of where the phone's camera is. But I've used it to find a few things, found some pens, found some bottle caps, just random stuff I might have dropped. And so I'm finding image recognition is saving me having to go find a sighted person to help me.
You know, after Shelley gave us that tip, I actually tried it out, and it was really kind of cool. It was like having someone there looking around, seeing what's on the floor, what's on the countertop. As I moved my phone around, the phone just told me what it saw, just like a person would. So check it out. It was fun.
Or you can let your wife help you find your wedding ring when you drop it on the floor.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
Let's start by meeting Shelley.
Well, Shelley, you've been on our show several times in the past talking about your very useful iOS books for accessibility concerns. But for those of our listeners who haven't heard you before, maybe you can introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Shelley Brisbane. I've been a technology journalist and writer for about 30 years. I've worked in the mainstream world covering things like Macintoshes and web development and wireless networking and the like. And 8 years or so ago, I started writing about accessibility. I'm visually impaired myself, and so I was interested in finally sort of addressing issues that I've been working on in my own life. And then the development of platforms like iOS from Apple meant that there was a lot more accessibility to write about. I'm also at my day job, I'm a radio producer with a statewide public radio show in Texas. And then I'm also the host of a number of podcasts, some of which have to do with technology. So basically I write and talk a lot is what I do.
So you know all about tech and all about access. You're the perfect person to be writing the book we'll be talking about today.
I'd like to think I wrote the right book. I wouldn't want to be writing the wrong book.
Support for Eyes on Success is made possible in part by our corporate partners.
Find out more about partnership opportunities by sending an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
This week's focus topic is the latest revision of Shelley Brisbane's book entitled iOS Access for All, The Comprehensive Guide to Accessibility for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch.
Now, as you mentioned, you've been putting these books together on iOS and Access and iOS for many years, and it's almost like a Bible. If you look at the table of contents, it just talks about everything in the world. But this year, there's a lot new in iOS 14, and you had to update the book quite a bit, I guess.
Yeah, it wasn't the biggest update I've ever had to do. I think the features this year are striking because of the way they use the technology that's already built into Apple's products. For example, machine learning. But I don't know that it's as big an upgrade as some have been in the past. I think probably 2-3 cycles ago was one of the bigger upgrades. And this is there's some nice new features. But I think for people who have been using iOS for a while, it's going to be familiar. There's just going to be a few new things in it that'll be interesting for them, both from an accessibility point of view and just a general usability point of view. And that table of contents is so long, just so that people can easily find what they want to find. It's the one book out there I know of that is comprehensive to all of the accessibility features in iOS. There's some other tools out there that focus, say, on voiceover or switch control, and those are great tools, and I like those resources a lot. But my goal was to make it possible for you to just pick one book up and be able to find some information about any accessibility-related topic that had to do with iOS.
It's a great reference book. Maybe you can just give us a quick overview of how the book is organized, and then we'll talk about some of the specific new features that came to iOS 14.
Sure. The book has 4 parts. The first part is introductory material explaining the Apple ecosystem and how the iOS operating system fits into it and the devices that Apple provides and a lot of the services that Apple provides that part continues to grow as Apple adds more services to its offerings. Then the second part is several chapters that are focused around specific disability categories. So there's a chapter for blind users, a chapter for people with low vision, one for folks with hearing impairments, and another for people with motor disabilities. So that's where you would go if your accessibility interest is highly specific. If you're more interested in how to use iOS generally, things that are included in the system, and if you have an iPad, then the third part includes chapters about those system level and iPad specific features. And then also the next part covers apps. So Apple bundles an incredible number of apps with its iPhones and iPads. And so I have a chapter, which is the biggest chapter in the book, that covers each and every one of those apps in varying levels of detail. And then I address the accessibility of each app. And then finally, there's a chapter where I cover some of the best third-party apps, mostly in brief. But the idea is, if you're wondering which apps out there are accessible and also happen to be really good iOS apps, that chapter is intended to be a compendium of that kind of information. So that gives you some idea of why it's so long.
I'd just like to comment, this table of contents is really written like an outline, and a fairly detailed outline. So it's very easy to drill down in. So if you're interested in a particular general topic, you can find all of the sub and sub topics all the way down to the finest detail just by looking through the table of contents.
I don't want to assume that anybody's going to read the whole book. I mean, even my mom hasn't read the whole book. But if you have a particular interest in mind, I want people to feel like, say, if they're a low vision user and will never open the chapter about hearing impairment, that they're getting their money's worth and that it's something that's worthwhile to them. So it functions both as a tutorial for somebody who might never have used iOS, but also as a reference for somebody who has.
And there's also a number of appendices that can be very useful that talk about hotkeys for using a Bluetooth keyboard with VoiceOver and Braille hotkeys, etc.
Yeah, there are four appendices. That one of them is, as you say, hotkeys for VoiceOver, as there's also a compendium of VoiceOver gestures, and then Braille keyboard shortcuts. And then finally, there's an appendix. It used to be part of Chapter 3, but it's basically how to set up an iOS device from scratch in VoiceOver, because it is completely possible as a blind person to set up your brand new iPhone with VoiceOver. But if you don't know those VoiceOver gestures, or if you kind of don't have the rhythm of it, you're going to very quickly be in a spot. And so I wrote this extensive appendix that says, here's how you do it.
That could be very useful. There are a lot of settings and customizations in particular.
Yes. Well, and the funny thing is, one of the first things you're asked to do when you get your new iPhone is to enter a Wi-Fi password. Well, if you've never typed on a virtual keyboard, that's going to be a little daunting for you. And so I go in fairly specific detail in that appendix. This is how you navigate the virtual keyboard. This is how you flick up. This is how you swipe left or swipe right. What those things actually mean in the context of setting up your iOS device.
As you mentioned, if people are used to using iOS devices, have used them in the past, the paradigm is still the same. So it's very usable, but there are some new features. And you mentioned particularly some of the features that are built on the AI that's built into the device. Can you talk about some of those features?
Apple has added machine learning capabilities to its hardware and also to its software APIs. And those are available, I should point out, in more recent iPhones and iPads, so the iPhone XR and forward. If you're not familiar with the iOS platform, we're at iPhone 12 now, but iPhone XR was a couple of years ago. And those are the first devices when machine learning hardware and software really became available. And it's now available on a few of the iPads as well. But what that meant is that Apple could not only provide access for people who wanted to do artificial intelligence or augmented reality kinds of things, but it meant that they could add some neat accessibility features that took advantage of those tools. The suite of features called VoiceOver Recognition is probably the best example.
So speaking of VoiceOver Recognition, tell us a little bit about it.
There are three parts to VoiceOver Recognition: image recognition, text recognition, and screen recognition. And overall, the goal of that set of features is to make it possible for you to get more information about your environment and what's going on your screen using machine learning. In other words, the device takes a look at what's going on, gives you, the VoiceOver user, audible information that you can then use to get access to information that you would otherwise not have because you don't have vision.
Give us some examples of how that works when one has their iOS device in front of them.
Sure. So image recognition works with any app that uses the camera. So the camera app or the magnifier app are good examples. If you open up the camera app and with VoiceOver on, of course, and with image recognition enabled, then the voiceover will tell you what it sees around you. So if you're out in your backyard, as I was the other day doing a demo, it might say table, trees, glass, hat. There was a hat on the table that I was using for my demo. So it attempts with machine learning to identify what those objects are in your field of view. And whether you want to take a photograph of that object or whether you just want to identify objects nearby, that's a very cool new feature.
So that can help you aim the camera and know what you're taking a picture of.
Yes, absolutely. And in theory, it could also help you find something that you dropped. It could help you understand your surroundings. Maybe you come into a new room. But yeah, it's absolutely useful for aiming the camera at the thing that you want to aim it at.
That's great. So what other ways does this work?
So screen recognition is an interesting feature because many apps are VoiceOver compatible. In other words, VoiceOver will read what's going on in the app, the interface, the button bar, that sort of thing. But some apps are not. And what that means is that the developer has not labeled buttons. He's not made that interface available to VoiceOver. Well, screen recognition attempts to solve that problem by using artificial intelligence to guess at what those interface items are. A back button, if you've never seen one, is usually a left-pointing arrow. So if your device sees a left-pointing arrow on that screen, it'll say something like, probably back button. If it sees a little button at the bottom left of the menu bar that is a picture of a house, it'll say, probably home button. It doesn't always work, but the idea is that it will interpret things even if they haven't been labeled for VoiceOver, meaning that some apps that are completely inaccessible otherwise are accessible. And what's nice about this feature, because it takes a little bit of horsepower, and there are a lot of times when you don't need it if you have a completely accessible app, is that you can enable it globally, or you can enable it on a per app basis. So in other words, you know a particular app isn't accessible, you enable screen recognition, and it's going to help you figure it out.
So just for people who are looking for that feature, I believe there are two ways of activating or not that feature on a per app basis.
Yeah, each of the features I've been talking about in VoiceOver recognition, image recognition, text recognition, and screen recognition, can either be turned on in settings or they can be turned on and off via the rotor. And then as far as the per app part of it, once you open up an app with one of those features enabled, it will add that to the list of apps for which it is supported. You can then go back in via settings and say, turn it off. Or if you're in an app, let's say you're in, there's an RSS reader I like called Reader that is unfortunately not very accessible. If I open up Reader, it knows that I want to use screen recognition with it, but using the rotor, I can also turn that off in real time if for some reason I don't want it.
And you mentioned there was a third way in which Apple is using these built-in AI features.
Text recognition is a nice one in that if you've ever spent any time on social media, you've probably encountered these image boxes that have text in them. There are all sorts of places in our lives where we see images that contain text, and it scans that text and it reads it aloud to you. It's similar to the way you would do it with an OCR app. You've always been able to, say, take an image and share it with something like NFB Reader or Scanner Pro or something like that and have it go and read the text to you. But this is built into the operating system. You don't have to go and share it out. You can open up that Twitter post, tap it to isolate the image, and then you can use VoiceOver gestures to have it read text. And it does a pretty good job.
It does. I'm impressed. I get a lot of text messages from our friends. They'll take a picture, and not only will VoiceOver describe the scene, tell you if there's people or a bridge or a tree in the picture, but if there's a sign in the picture, it will often read the sign that's in the picture.
Yep, that's very helpful.
On the other hand, it does occasionally get it wrong. Many of our friends send out pictures of beautiful sunsets, and we live in Golden, Colorado, a couple miles from where the foothills start into the Rockies. And the other day, the clouds were lit up bright red, and VoiceOver guessed that there was a fire in the sky.
Yeah, it does make mistakes. And I've seen that with image recognition, too. And I've done things like array a set of objects on a table and point my phone at them to try and see if it can identify them correctly. Sometimes it makes mistakes that, to my mind, are honest mistakes, and sometimes they're funny. I had a folding white cane that I didn't really expect it to identify, and it said it was a pen and pencil. It's a really big pen. It correctly identified my red hat. It thought my face mask was a black shirt. You know, things like that. But it's often in the ballpark. And I think Apple would say the same thing. You shouldn't rely on this for life or death situations. If you think that there's a fire in your picture, you should probably get some additional information to find out if that's true. My favorite one, just because I just remembered it, was I took my phone out to sort of go down the street and see what I could see. It's really good at identifying cars and their colors, which could be helpful if your friend is coming to get you and they have a red car and you can't see that. So I walked up the street and, red car, shrubbery, street sign. And then it says, house, probably a scene of destruction. There was a little stuff in the front yard, but it wasn't that bad.
Oh, boy. One of the other new features I thought was interesting was the app library. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So a lot of us, if we've had our phones for any period of time, have probably downloaded a bunch of apps. You can obviously delete apps. You can put them in folders. You can put them in other home screens. But app library is something that Apple created to essentially alleviate the need for that sort of organization of your apps if you don't want to. So any app that you have downloaded, you can go to this screen called App Library where you can search for an app. Apps are organized into folders by category that Apple has created. So you could go and look in your productivity apps and find all the apps that meet that description. You could go in games and utilities and the same sort of thing. So the idea is if you just don't want to organize your apps or if you just forget to organize your apps, App Library is there waiting for you. So it's a quick way to not have to search for apps. It just gives you an alternative way of looking at the contents of your home screen.
Yes, it can be a great way to get a good overview of what's on your screen. As you say, if you're looking for a particular app, you don't know which page it's on. It could be in a subfolder. You could search forever, but going to the app library makes that a really easy task.
Well, and the other way of doing that, every once in a while, we'll use each other's phone, and I have no idea how his apps are organized and vice versa. And I just turn on Siri and say, open whatever app I'm looking for, because I'd never find it.
Exactly.
The other feature I've been having fun with is the ability to put widgets on your home screen. Can you tell people a little bit about what widgets are and how they can be useful?
Widgets are really fun. So if you've used iOS before, if you've used the Today view, so you flick right from your home screen and there's this screen where there are little boxes with information about your calendar and about weather and about news and what other apps you are interested in that you put on that page. That's been around for a while. But Apple basically souped this feature up and gave developers the ability to create widgets, which are either little squares, little rectangles, or bigger squares. And each app can contain as many different kinds of widgets as the developer can think to have. So, for example, a weather app could have a widget that is just the temperature and another widget that is the five-day forecast. A calendar app could have here's my day and another widget that's a monthly view. So it gives you as a user a lot of options. Say, I love this app. I want to know the weather and I want to know the events coming up on my calendar, but I have a particular way that I want to see them. So those are available in Today view, as they always have been, with the addition of this customization I was just talking about. But now you can also put a widget on your home screen. So one of those little squares that is the weather, just today's temperature, could go onto the home screen in the place where part of the app grid was.
And what's interesting about the widgets is you can see this information without having to open the app. So if you have the weather widget, you'll just see the temperature there. You don't have to open the weather app and then go close it again and go back to your home screen.
Exactly. It's a little like having an Apple Watch. That, to me, is one of the values of an Apple Watch, is that you can look at this small bit of information, just the information that you want or need at that moment.
What other feature of the widgets is, as you mentioned, they will normally take up a little bit more space on your home screen. So some of these take up a 2x2 grid instead of just their single slot there. But it's nice that you can actually stack the widgets on top of each other and easily swipe from one to the next.
Right. They call that a smart stack, and that's available either on the home screen or on the Today view. But you can stack any set of widgets in any way you want to. And one way might be, this is the set of widgets that I want access to as I'm working through my day's appointments and stuff like that. Or maybe you have a photo widget, and then you have a widget for a social network. So you have like a smart stack that's all about things that are fun or things that are, you know, visually pretty if you're using Vision.
What other new features in iOS 14 would you like to highlight?
So there's one feature that's available only in a few iOS devices, but that I think has a lot of implications for accessibility going forward. It's called People Detection, and you need to have an iPhone 12 Pro, 12 Pro Max, or 2020 iPad Pro. Now, what do those three devices have in common in addition to support for machine learning features? Well, they also have a LiDAR scanner. LiDAR is the same scanner that's used by autonomous vehicles to help the vehicle understand its surroundings. And so LiDAR is included in those devices. A lot of it is to help photographers because it assists them in understanding lighting conditions and measuring the distance between the photographer and the object and that sort of thing. But for accessibility purposes, there's a feature called people detection that allows the magnifier app to tell you whether there is a person in proximity to your viewfinder and how far away they are. And so that would be useful if you walk into a room and we're in the pandemic mode. So if you want to stay socially distant from somebody, it could tell you there is a person 5 feet away. Well, I'd like to be 6 feet away or 7 feet away so I can move accordingly. Or maybe you're going to a restaurant or getting on a bus and you want to make sure that the chair that you'd like to occupy is not already occupied. So it can tell you there's a person there. Or there isn't there, or if it doesn't tell you anything, then you know there's not a person there and that the chair is available for you. And for some people, I think that's going to seem like a no big deal kind of feature. And it's probably not a reason that somebody would buy a device as expensive as an iPad Pro or an iPhone 12 Pro. But LiDAR is a super interesting feature from an accessibility point of view because it's going to make it possible for Apple and other developers to create navigation apps that give us information about our surroundings. It doesn't have to be people. It can be how far away is this specific kind of object. You combine it with machine learning and it can say, this is a street sign, it's 10 feet away from you. This is an obstacle and it's 10 feet away from you. All sorts of information will become available in the future based on this LiDAR scanner. And right now you can see a little bit of how it works with this people detection feature. Again, it's in the Magnifier app and you have to have one of these high-end phones to use it.
Boy, that is really cool. So is there anything we missed that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I'll talk about one other accessibility feature that is not really specific to the use of blind folks. In fact, it's probably more useful for people with hearing impairments. It's called sound recognition. And this one is, I've played with it a little bit, and it's interesting. And again, it's not something that you should rely on, but it is really a cool implementation of technology. In sound recognition, when you turn it on, there are a number of sounds that you can tell iOS to try and identify. And they include things like dogs barking, doorbell ringing, water running. Okay, why would you want to identify those sounds in your environment? Well, if you have a hearing impairment, you might not be aware of those sounds, baby crying, things like that. Those are the kind of sounds that might alert you that you need to take an action. If your baby's crying, you probably want to go see it. If the doorbell's ringing, you probably want to go answer the door. And when one of those sounds is detected, it will flash a light on your device and you'll get a notification that that has happened. But I find that to be a really cool feature and would probably help some folks with hearing impairments.
Well, it will be interesting to see how Apple builds on these AI technologies and LiDAR technologies in future versions of their devices.
Yes.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Now for this week's final item, how to learn more about Shelley Brisbane's book, how to get it, and how to contact her directly.
Remind our listeners, Shelley, about the name of your book and how people can obtain it.
My book is called iOS Access for All, Your Comprehensive Guide to Accessibility for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch, and that title pretty much says it all. You can buy it at my website, which is iosaccessbook.com. It's also available in the Apple Bookstore. If you buy it from my site, you can get it in EPUB or PDF format. The format at the Apple Bookstore is also EPUB. I like it a little better if you buy it from me because then I get the benefit of all the money and Apple doesn't get a cut. But I'm happy to have you buy from Apple if that's more convenient for you. The iOS 14 version is out now and you can buy the book in any format for $25. Some people are interested in having the book in both EPUB and PDF format. So if you want both kinds, you can get a zip archive that has both of them for $30.
Do you have a social media presence?
You can find me on Twitter at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y. The book also has a Twitter account, iOS Access Book. You can follow me at either place or both.
And if somebody wants to ask you a question, what's the best way to reach you?
Probably Twitter. Just tweet me at Shelley or at iOS Access Book.
And you mentioned that you have a podcast. Can you tell us a little about the podcast and how people can listen to that?
My podcast is called Parallel, a tech podcast with accessibility sprinkles. What I do is I get folks from the mainstream tech world. I have a lot of friends who are journalists and developers and other folks who just work in technology, don't particularly have to do with accessibility. But then I have a lot of acquaintances and people I'm aware of in the accessibility community as well. And I don't think we talk very often. So what I like to do is bring folks from the mainstream and the accessibility world together. We'll talk about a technology topic and there will be some accessibility discussed, but we have a conversation that I think people in the mainstream can also enjoy. You can find that at relay.fm/parallel.
And you can find all that contact information in the show notes associated with this episode at www.eyesonsuccess.net. As long as we're talking about iOS devices, I want to remind our listeners about the search field on our website. We've done many shows on iOS devices, different apps, and different applications for these devices. So if you put iOS into the search field or Apple into the search field,